Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots. Good afternoon, Lindsay.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm well. We probably should acknowledge at the top of this that it's been a hot minute since we put out an episode.
It has been a hot minute. But you and I, in each of our own ways, are perfectionists. And we've had a lot going on. I don't know. I feel like we're not here to just churn out bad content. We're here to, like, produce quality content.
Right, okay, sure. That's great. Yeah, this, our solemn oath to you is we'll never put out bad content. No, there was a couple of things. And actually, I will say, we started recording this episode probably 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And then an opportunity came up.
Mm-hmm. A really, really exciting and unexpected opportunity.
And it didn't quite pan out the way that we thought.
No.
But maybe we should introduce the episode.
Yes. For a bit of context for listeners who might be joining, either if you've listened to every episode and it has been a hot minute for you, or if you're joining us new, we've been doing a series on Great Scots.
Yes.
The people behind kind of the best of Scottish food history. We've been interviewing chefs, we've been interviewing food writers, and we're really digging into the people who made Scottish food what it is today, right?
But I have no antique cookery book, no ancestral bag of grains.
No.
But I do see on the table before us some confectionery delights. Lindsay, who are we talking about today?
We are talking tunnocks.
Talking tunnocks. Can we abandon the Scottish Food History podcast and just start another one called
tunnocks.
Talking Tunnocks? Yeah. Tunnocks, big part of your life growing up?
Yeah, massively. And especially when living in Canada. So I moved to Canada when I was three. I moved back when I was seven. And obviously, like, by that point, I hadn't had a massive chance to, like, imbricate myself in Scottish culture.
Imbricate.
Imbricate. Oh, I love that word. It's such
PhD
a good one.
Words.
These bloody academics.
Sorry, you're imbricating.
I'm imbricating, right? I hadn't had a chance to, like, really imbricate myself in Scottish culture or know what that was. But my mother, my Glaswegian lovely mother, was incredibly homesick when we moved out to Scotland.
Who we met on the last episode.
We did. And she's lovely. Shout out to you, Ali. But her Scottishness, I feel like, ramped up quite a lot when we moved to Canada, because as a sort of a way of trying to keep that and not be too homesick. So I remember watching episodes and episodes of Hamish Macbeth, which is very, like, twee Scottish mystery about this policeman in the Highlands, and also eating things like tunnocks. So they were like the rarest of rare treats, because you could buy them in Canada, but they were incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
So it was basically like shipped over in suitcases when we used to go back to Scotland to visit. Mm-hmm. So it would be things like tunnocks, good tea bags, because North Americans don't really do tea in the way we do tea.
No.
And also like black pudding and potato scones, Thai scones. So tunnocks for me is like early, like, this is a rare treat.
It's a touchstone.
Yes.
For the entirety of Scottish culture.
Exactly. Whether you're diaspora, whether you're in Canada, whether you're not at home at the moment. Yeah. And I think beyond that, when living back in Scotland, it to me is like the most iconic, modern yet traditional product that we do. Like the wrapping. Everyone knows the wrapping, the packaging. It's crazy.
Yeah.
What about you? What was tunnocks always a thing for you?
It was always a thing. I can't necessarily say that it was something we had a lot of, because it was more expensive than standard confectionery.
Mm-hmm.
However, I definitely think that it sits on the same plate as birthday cake and Hogmanay shortbread.
Yeah.
And like when it was like the someone's coming over for tea,
yeah,
grab something nice.
Exactly. It's like above your standard biscuit. It's like, yeah, you know,
it's more than a Freddo, less than a Gatto. That's where...
Nice, nice rhyme.
We've been talking a lot about getting some merch for the Scottish Food History Podcast, and I think more... What did I just say?
More than a Freddo, less than a Gatto.
Yeah, Tunnocks.
That's us. Tunnocks
talk. But yeah, and for me, a tea cake is the classique.
Yeah.
It is the epitome of the Tunnocks confectionery range.
And I think you're right. There's something about it having a bit of specialness about it. Like, they're individually wrapped. You can't just crack open a packet. Like, you can't have half of one and then leave it. There's something about a tea cake is an individual experience. That it was if you got a plate of tea cakes out, you were wanting to impress people.
Yeah.
I love them.
A tea cake is a moment.
A tea cake is a moment. Right. So for people who maybe aren't Scottish, who maybe, and as I'm sure we'll talk about, Tunnocks has a vast global reach. Yeah. But if you don't know what a tea cake is...
If you're in the heart of Texas.
If you've been living under a rock, can you describe for us what a tea cake is, Peter?
So a tea cake is what presents itself as a chocolate dome and is wrapped in this vaguely communist China... stripe and stars tin foil in the best possible way.
It's beautiful.
Way.
I'm gonna crackle some of the foil
for ASMR.
Yeah.
Within, once disrobed from its foil shell, you are presented with a dome of the most exquisite. A standard milk chocolate does come in a variety of. I've never seen a white chocolate.
Tunnocks. That would be awful. I don't think they exist.
I'm a white chocolate man, but anyway.
Are you? Interesting. Yeah.
Inside, you will find the dome is created through Italian meringue. Mm. I believe a boiled Italian meringue is what it was originally.
It does say now it's mallow, so I wonder if it's maybe changed, but I suppose it's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
Yes. There is a distinction coming later on.
No.
Which we will hold on to your hats, folks. This episode is filled with family lore, light corporate espionage, and the dissection of Scottish culture. But anyway, yeah, so it's an Italian meringue marshmallow on essentially a shortbread biscuit.
Yeah, quite
covered
thin,
covered in chocolate. Because there are other tea cakes that I found from down south, which are more like a yeasted, fritted hot cross bun type thing.
Or like a rock cake or something. Yeah.
Yes. But maybe we should get this started, because we are talking about the people behind Tunnocks.
Yes.
And this story, I think, can really be organised into maybe three acts.
Okay.
A three-act play.
Like a delicious drama.
And our first act opens with Thomas Tunnock. So Act 1 opens with Thomas Tunnock, the man who gave the business his name, and he was born in 1865 at Fairview Place on Old Mill Road, Bothwell, Lanarkshire, Scotland.
Wow, okay.
The son of a coffin maker.
Right, that's quite a jump from coffins to...
confectionery.
We presume confectionery, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I think there's a lot of... There's some blurb online about his dad being quite comical with his coffin.
Yes, I think
promotions.
I've seen...
Have you seen this?
I think I have seen this. So apparently his advertisements for his coffins read, "Why live a miserable life when for 30 bob you can be buried comfortably?"
You see, no. Just as someone who's going to approach business with that level of humour...
Especially the business of death. Yeah.
I actually don't know a lot about his upbringing and his family, just obviously that his dad was quite creative in business.
Yeah.
And the first kind of inkling that we get to this Mr. Thomas Tunnock getting involved in food is in 1897, around the age, in his 30s. And he is catering a St. Patrick's Day meal.
So he's catering.
So, yeah, he's catering, and he actually, as we see over the next few years, we begin to see him taking on more and more catering. So everything from a tatty and heron night for 30 gentlemen, which was a programme of vocal and instrumental impromptu selections with really excellent food terminating at a reasonable hour. That was the official review.
Terminating at a reasonable hour.
Given. And we see actually, like, over the next kind of 5 to 10 years, Thomas Tunnock is essentially catering everything that's happening in like Lanarkshire. And it's everything from kind of tea and cakes for the OAPs to your, like, Glasgow City Hall baking masters.
Nice.
You know, he's doing it all.
Things at all levels.
He's building himself a reputation as being someone of quality and someone who definitely who gets more into doing high teas as the years go on.
Interesting.
And actually, at 1903, and we get to the beginning of the 1900s, he's obviously built a bit of a reputation for himself because as the trams are being laid that's going out to Lanarkshire, going out to Uddingston, he's invited to lay the last brick, the last causey, if you remember from our conversation about causeys, the last brick. And in it, there's tea for Thomas.
Thomas Tunnock. I feel like it's such a strong name, it's almost like a given that he had to start a really successful family business from it.
Like
Thomas Tunnock. You're not just going to not do anything with that.
Peter Gilchrist. Lindsay Middleton.
Lindsay Middleton's got far too many syllables in it to ever be snappy. You need the alliteration, you need the...
Yeah.
Thomas Tunnock.
Thomas Tunnock has got it. So Thomas Tunnock opens a cafe. And it's at this end, the end in Uddingston, in the town centre at the end of the tram line.
Nice.
And he does this really interesting thing, which we are seeing more of today, is as businesses are trying to kind of survive and put themselves ahead, Thomas Tunnock makes his cafe, Tunnock's, a depot for the tram lines.
Ah.
So if you are sending or picking up or collecting a parcel, you have to go into his cafe.
Oh, that's such good business sense.
Such good business sense.
Because you would go in and, of course, even if you weren't hungry, you would see a cake or you'd smell a cup of tea and you would be like, oh, I could just stop or take something away.
Exactly. And also building on, you know, we just obviously had the Scottish Food History Symposium.
Yes.
And in that we were learning all about tea rooms. Our next episode is going to jump into the history of tea rooms in a bigger way. But we do see that cafes, tea rooms, they begin to become places of business.
Yes.
Especially around the working class and especially around kind of...
like the temperance movement, people who aren't engaging in drinking. This was a massive social thing at the time, late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yep.
The culture is trying to shift away from pub culture. So you have these alternative spaces springing up where it's like a place where you meet someone for a business lunch, you can stop when you're at work. The other really interesting thing for me about this is the link to transport. It's like, okay, a recognition that working patterns are changing, transport patterns are changing, and now people are more on the go in a way that they haven't been previously.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're getting a tram or you're commuting, like commuting culture is starting and having those options along the way so you're not needing to take all your food or you're not going to be hungry throughout the day is that's where this really starts, which is fascinating.
And it's really creative.
As a
businessman, he's incredibly creative. And this is something, again, that maybe he did get from his father.
Yeah, with his...
It's certainly inherited by his son and has certainly been inherited by his grandson, who I got to speak to.
You did. This was crazy. This was so exciting. And this was one of the reasons...
This episode got delayed was I had sent a wee email to Tunnock's to say... Mm-hmm. We have a podcast. And then I got a phone call from Uddingston.
Wow. So do you see the area code?
I saw the area code that came up Uddingston and it said Uddingston. And I was like, oh, this is going to be someone at Tunnock's.
Mm-hmm.
Some person from the comms team calling to say, really sorry.
We don't have time for
this. We don't have time for you because we're f***ing Tunnock's. And instead I was met by the voice of Boyd Tunnock, the inventor of the tea cake and grandson of Thomas Tunnock. Now, I've got a few clips from our phone call. Please do forgive the quality because I was grabbing my hands-free mic whilst I was on the phone after we'd already been talking for 5 minutes and then captured kind of the last bit of our chat. He's also given us a couple of answers... an email if we want to read them out. We'll do it later on.
Mm-hmm.
But so back to Thomas Tunnock. Mm-hmm. He's really made himself a name in the community. He's obviously built a really successful business.
He's done it very creatively. He's mm-hmm. he's tapping into like the new upcoming infrastructures that are changing city planning, all yeah. this kind of thing. He's on the cutting edge of confectionery.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this time we have World War One that kicks in.
Right.
And that does have a detrimental impact on the bakery. Mm-hmm. And Thomas does say to his son, who joined the business as a kind of an apprentice and had been obviously working with him, says to Archie mm-hmm. that he needs to move on.
Right.
At the moment, so the business can survive.
Yeah.
Archie
Who's Thomas's son, right?
Yes. Yeah. Archie's Thomas's son. So Archie first gets into some other work and then signs up for the war.
Right.
So he leaves for the war. 1916, mm-hmm. Archie goes off to war. Now, he spends the entire 4 years of from 1916 to 1920, doesn't come home.
Wow.
Is spending his time in what is kind of modern day Iraq, so like Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
And he finally mm-hmm. comes home mm-hmm. January 1920.
Right.
Just after the Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah.
He's coming in to Glasgow Central. Mm-hmm. Steam.
Yep.
Filling corridors of steam, filling the air. The crisp Glasgow cold, harsh winter.
Gosh, that must have felt so different.
After 4 years of living in the Middle East. And he gets off the train, mm-hmm. gets to the top of the platform. Someone he knows from back home is there.
Right.
And says, "Archie, your dad's just died."
Oh my God.
So he died, I think, a couple of weeks previous.
Right. And of course, there's no way of getting that communication to you, especially when you're travelling at that point in time.
And the family don't know who it was. If it was a friend, if it was someone who saw him and thought, I should be the one to tell him. But we know that he arrives home having heard.
Right. Okay.
In Glasgow Central.
I can't even imagine like being in the midst of the horrors of war and then it's like the strange reversal of the typical tale where normally the son who'd gone abroad would be the one to be killed. And then finally coming home after what was probably very limited contact with your family for those 4 years.
Yep. And his dad wasn't old. You know, he certainly wasn't of an advanced age where this was something you'd be expecting. Mm-hmm. But this brings us to the end of Act 1.
The end of because Act 1 of the Tunnock's Tale.
Of the Tunnock's Tale, because Act 2 mm-hmm. is Archie's Tunnock's.
So we're beginning Act 2 of our Tunnock's Tale with Archie Tunnock's, son of Thomas Tunnock, mm-hmm. who's just returned from the war to the news that his dad has passed away. Peter, tell us more about Archie Tunnock.
Well, Archie comes back to the business, and what for all that we can find, the evidence is saying that the business is struggling. Okay. It struggled through the war, as lots of hospitality businesses did, and we don't really see anything for a year after Archie comes home. But a year later, mm-hmm. in the British newspaper archives in Uddingston, we can see that Archie is catering the Burns Club Halloween supper.
Ah, so he's jumped right back into catering.
And I think, again, this will be the practice that he's seen because he was working with his dad at the time, and his dad was building the catering business that then became the cafe, came the bakery. And he's using that Tunnock's name.
Yeah.
And there are references to him stepping into his dad's shoes and newspapers, obviously as this kind of like revered man in the community.
Yeah.
His son, after serving at war, I'm assuming a bit of a hero to people
resumes the family business. And I know that there would be an expectation around that, but it wasn't a given all the time.
No.
So he's come in and he's actually stepped up to the plate.
And he's stepping up to the plate at a time when there probably isn't as much money.
Yeah.
But he does the same thing where he begins to build up this community business mm-hmm. where it's catering. He reopens the cafes, he builds onto it and begins to supply Scotland, and moves into deliveries.
Okay.
And seeing the Tunnocks van becomes something that we see coming through newspapers again, where people are talking about the classic Tunnocks van and the new shop opening and the new, you know, stock now available at your local and such. But I do have a clip here from Boyd.
Sir Boyd.
Sorry. Sir Boyd Tunnock. A wonderful man who has a lot to say about his family legacy. But he goes on, in this moment, he goes on to talk to me a wee bit about how his dad began to prepare for World War II and how Tunnocks eventually began to grow.
Then he went on, and during the war, there was a lot of catering, outside functions, and he could go do a wedding, a house wedding, you know, for maybe for a dozen people or so, or else he could go to a hall where he was catering for 200. And he built this business up during the war, but when the war came along, of course, everything stopped, and they were back to the shop, just selling out of the shop only. But he had big rations, because they based your rations on what you had actually purchased before the war. He had big rations, so the shop did very well, actually, you know. So, but he was a great innovator and always thinking the ways of doing things better. They just kept going from there. And it wasn't until after the war that he started. We're in cakes. We're selling cakes from our vans. I think it was 3 or 4 vans in Glasgow at the time. And then in 1947, he came across to where we are today in Old Mill Road. That allowed him to expand and do more things. And it wasn't really till 1952 that along came the caramel wafers. And, you know, he had tried with various things. Those days, Penguin was a huge success.
Yeah.
And my father tried copying that, but it was no use. It was no use, because in actual fact, they were so strong that we could only sell a few. But then he bought in wafers from a firm up in Hamilton. And he could buy these wafers in. And then he got a chap to come out from Glasgow and show them how to make caramel. Then we spread it onto the wafers and cut them and then wrapped them by hand and then got machines. And it just went on from there to there, you know. And then I think it was 1955, he bought his first wafer oven where we could make our own wafers. Found it was more productive to do that, you know. And then it was new machinery and wrappers and all that. You were wrapping maybe 60 a minute. You thought that was great. And now we've got 6 machines that will do 400 a minute. Just went on from there. You know, so that was the whole thing was they were making things that people wanted to buy.
Wow.
So again, what he's talking about there is the process of them moving from being a bakery and catering to throughout the war, doing reasonably well just because of how busy they had been before the war and their rationing being based on that. And then beginning to look at their competitors. So he was talking there about Penguin.
Yes, that's so funny, isn't it?
Because I forget Penguin is a McVitie's.
Yeah.
But before it was McVitie's, it was McDonald's of Glasgow, a biscuit manufacturer. McDonald's of Glasgow was the big competition for Tunnocks.
Yeah.
And so it's at this time where they're working with Lees of Scotland, where they're making the snowballs.
Yeah.
They are developing their recipes that they have in-house and beginning to look for potential to make prepackaged products as opposed to just kind of shelf-ready fresh products. And they get the guy in from Hamilton that can do the wafers and the guy that can come in from the other side to do the caramel. And are slowly building this business.
And what was really interesting to me there is like the recognition that moving this forward was all about mechanization, right? It was about getting the machines in, being able to do the wrapping yourself. Like, this is very much a clear story of like smart adaptation of different innovations so that you could do more but keep your standards high and kind of just expand along those lines.
Yeah. And so, I mean, who we're talking about here is Archie.
Yes.
Again, we're talking about this man who comes in after World War One. He's been at war. He comes back into a business as it's kind of hitting the ground a bit. And he begins to rebuild it, but then sets his aspirations much higher.
Mm-hmm.
And Tunnocks, as we get into the 40s and 50s, is becoming a brand name.
Right.
Because their big thing is about stock.
Yes.
They're moving it into the new department stores, the new chain supermarkets that are opening up, like Galbraith that's taking over Scotland. They're trying to get stocked in all these places. Mm. And it becomes a very accessible purchase. And then when you're doing kind of advertising and newspaper adverts and on the side of trams, people are able to recognise products.
Yes.
And buy them at their local shop. Mm. It's about that market saturation.
Exactly.
Go back to my degree.
And like recognisable branding, right? It was like not just the name, but like by this point, the wrappers, things that were becoming like, oh, I can buy that and I know it's going to be good because it's Tunnocks.
And there's a really nice thing that happens at this time as well, because they're tearing up the tram lines in 1948, and two of the builders that are working on the lines know the reputation of Archie and knew Archie's dad, and when they're ripping out the tram lines, take the
last cosy that
has the TT on it, and give it back.
That's so nice
to Archie to have in his office.
And it also shows the like enduring nature of the name, like across generations.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't just that, okay, it's just Tunnocks. Like at this point they're still very much relating it to the individual men and the family and what they were doing in society.
Yeah. And the thing about Archie, I think even more than his dad, because his dad definitely did a lot of catering for the community, but his dad Archie did an enormous amount of work. Sorry, his son Archie, boy's dad Archie, did an enormous amount of work for charity.
Mm.
So catering for 15,000 people at the Uddingston Show in 1946.
Wow.
And he organised these Halloween parties in 1951 for all the local young people to come into the Tunnocks factory.
Oh.
So again, it's like a way of like, you are based in the community. Your survival is based in the community. Tunnocks could begin to pull away from the community.
Yeah.
They could begin to be entirely focused on the private enterprise and survival of the business.
Outsourcing work and that kind of thing. But yeah.
Archie goes on to become a counsellor.
Mm.
And he's an elder in his local church. And it's very much based in, inside of that community.
So Archie's at this point, as you said, like making products that can be distributed around the country, that have a longer shelf life, that are packaged. We spoke a bit about a tea cake, but what other products were these?
Well, we have a caramel log.
Yes.
Now, I think the wafer was first, but I have a personal relationship with the caramel log, which is when I was the student union president for Heriot Watt, the Scottish Borders Campus School of Textiles. Hi, everyone.
That's so you. That's very funny.
We asked Tunnocks if they could send us some freebies so we can give them out to students during Freshers Week and exam time. Now, we have approximately 650 students in the entire school.
Okay.
And we're in the Galashiels, we're in the Borders.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you're kind of out of the way.
It's small numbers, okay? Tunnocks sends a truck with a pallet.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 10,000 caramel logs. No. I think they just hear university and they're used to like a uni package, like, send it on the truck. No.
Wow.
So for 2 years, because I was revoted in, thank you very much, everyone.
Applause.
I'm to this day, blame the current waist size that I have to buy for my jeans is entirely the fault of caramel logs and the fact that I probably ate maybe 500 of them in 2 years.
So I'm actually like a recent convert to caramel log culture. Previously I was more of a tea cake. This has been a recent thing that I've started eating them. What's the main difference? Because it is essentially a caramel wafer, which is like the sort of thin layers of wafer with the caramel coated in chocolate.
A caramel log is then dipped in a toasted coconut. I'm going to open this one right in front of me. Actually, this is so messy.
They are messy, but like the coconut adds so much.
It does. When I think about what are the flavours of Scottish confectionery, I think about coconut.
Yeah.
And it probably is solely down to the caramel log. I can't think of anything else that has coconut in it.
I don't know. Again, like the snowball has coconut on the outside.
Right, no, actually, you're right.
But it is, it's that kind of like sweet, tray bakey.
I'm going to try a bit just now.
Okay. Whenever I've not eaten a huge amount of anything, I'm always like, oh, maybe my mum didn't like it. But that doesn't make sense because she loves a bounty. But yeah, it is. It doesn't have, because it's toasted, it's not like a in-your-face coconutty flavour, but it's just like, it adds a texture and a nuttiness that like really complements the caramel. It feels maybe more grown up than a caramel wafer. I don't know.
We know that Tunnocks is competing with the other big confectionery, other big confectioners of the time, Lee's of Scotland and McDonald's of Glasgow being the two. Mm-hmm. And so actually moving into places with mallow and coconut and chocolate, layering with biscuits, wafers and caramel, these are all the main components of the competition of Glasgow confectionery.
Mm.
I do feel like there needs to be a Tunnocks program.
Yes.
A six, I think you could do it in like a three acts.
Yes.
Six episodes with two.
We're giving you the formula. Come on, BBC Scotland.
Yeah, please. at Netflix, at STV Creative.
Yeah.
There's a story to be had here. But the original was the caramel wafer, which is just caramel pinched between wafer thin wafers covered in chocolate.
And I think the thing about it is, like, I'm not a massive, I don't have a huge sweet tooth. And I actually, in a lot of circumstances, quite dislike caramel. I think it's too overpoweringly sweet. But the beauty about both a caramel log and a caramel wafer is it's like very, very thin amounts of caramel. So it basically just gels the biscuit together rather than it being like gooing out.
Yeah.
And it's delicious.
So under the steer of Archie, Tunnocks, after the mid-century, begins to really explode across Scotland and internationally as well.
Yeah.
Because for so many people like me and you, Tunnocks is a touchstone, a representative of great Scottish food, something to remind you of home.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very iconic. I mean, there are pillows with the branding on, right? It's like it becomes, a very recognisable brand.
But there was a need for a new product to be invented.
To be competing with those other big dogs in the confectionery world.
Exactly. And I am going to play for you a voice note from Boyd talking about Boyd's start and his invention of the tea cake.
I was into the bakery in 1954. I was 49 because I was learning to be a baker's apprentice, and I was behind the shop in the main street. And from there, I actually went into the army in 1954 till 56, and I was in the catering corps. We're cooking for about 600 a day. You know, it was very rough cooking, and it was coal fires in those days, and we were actually doing the cooking, you know, and it was an enjoyable time, you know, learning how to cook and how to do things. And then came back and they started, and well, when I was away, of course, father had progressed with the caramel wafers, and then started making snowballs. And they discovered that snowballs were a good seller. Worked with these. And then when I came by, I think it was about 1957, when we had an agent who was selling the caramel wafers. And those days we used to do chocolate cups with our shells, you know, for cakes. We sell them to bakers all over Scotland. And this Mr. Watson from Bear's Den, he said, why don't you copy that? In those days it was McDonald's Penguin and McDonald's Munch Mallows. And then what actually happened was they were actually done with gelatin, so because they were tough compared to our ones with Bob Meringue, so the snowballs. So Mr. Boss says, why don't you put some of that snowball cream in a biscuit and then cover it with chocolate, and you can then wrap it? And it went on from there.
Wow.
So the story of the invention of the tea cake, Mr. Watson, who was an agent
from
Bear's Den. I'm assuming that the role of an agent is finding stockists
and probably like sourcing competition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is pointing out that McDonald's of Glasgow, the biscuit manufacturer, has a product called the Munchmallow.
Munchmallow. Awful name.
And they should develop a product to compete. I'm about to show you a picture from before the Tunnocks tea cake was invented. And I just want your reaction to the Munchmallow.
Oh my God. Wow. Okay. So what I'm seeing is a tea cake wrapped in foil that is red and silver and stripy, and very much like if Little Middle Isle did a Tunnocks tea cake. That's what it would look like. Wow.
So what we have here, the adage of don't do it first, do it best.
Do it second, but better. It's chocolate espionage.
It is.
Wow.
Absolutely.
And I like that point from Boyd there that, like, they use gelatin in their mallow, so yes. It was tough and probably quite chewy, whereas they had this nice,
boiled,
soft,
meringue.
Lovely meringue.
Yeah. I do hope that the Tunnocks retired Mr. Watson from Bear's Den.
Yeah, he deserved a big recognition for that.
That agent needed a... But it's such a funny, like, a look at... I think when I think about tea cakes, I think about these singular products, and the question is, how did they become iconic?
Right,
above everything else. Mm-hmm. But actually, that's our generation thinking about that, because the generation that we're around... Mm. We're seeing versions of this product.
Exactly. Had options. It was like, oh, which kind of tea cake in the red and silver foil do you want to buy?
Yes, like, exactly. Yeah. And you have this, like, private sector competition, which is where I think it could get really nitty-gritty in the Netflix six-part series.
This is why we need
series.
The drama. I'm thinking, like, the Gilded Age, but it's biscuits.
Yeah, exactly. Biscuit Wars. Something like that. Oh, my gosh. But, yes, so a lot of... these inventions are coming through from Tunnocks. They also did snowballs.
Yes.
And first, I think, in relationship with Lee's, maybe Lee's manufactured them for them, mm-hmm. or there was definitely...
An exchange going on.
An exchange happening there. Yeah. But it's actually tied to this entire culture of 1940s, 1950s biscuit making.
That's
and the
so
competition
funny.
That forged these standout products.
Wow. I love that. I feel like, yeah, in terms of, like, product design, salesmanship, having that really strong brand, it's amazing that, like, this came out as the successful one.
Yeah.
And I love that idea of, you know, Boyd being in the factory. I enjoyed hearing also about him, like, being a baker's apprentice. Like, this wasn't just, like, inherited, okay, now you're part of the family. This was it was like learning the skills and doing it on all levels. It was like the actual, I can bake the things. I'm not just overseeing the business, or I'm not just going to step into that when Archie steps down eventually.
Yeah.
It's like actually learning a trade and then just like playing about with a chocolate shell. I love the fact that also they were already making these domes for other businesses.
Yeah.
So there's part of it that's like, we have this, we're outsourcing it, but how can we... take advantage of that.
Yeah. I wish they had continued to develop more.
Yeah.
Because I feel like they hit it out the park with the first six odd products that they made. And obviously in more recent years they've added dark chocolate versions and things like that.
And is this how obviously, you know, Archie's still very much involved in the business? And his son Boyd is inventing tea cakes. Where does this take us in our family story?
Well, I think Act Two really ends in 1981.
Okay.
Because this is when Archie passes away.
Right.
And Archie has been obviously the kind of figurehead and the...
Yeah, and it's worth saying, like, during all that time, they're opening factories, they've got other cafes opening, like, in terms of, like, footprint and scale, the business is very much continuing to grow in that kind of post-war era.
Yeah, and kind of as Boyd was alluding to, they're constantly adding and upgrading the factory.
Yeah,
he went in and we had a really, he talked a wee bit about all the different ways that the machines were adapted and adopted, and the fact that you can only wrap 100 tea cakes a minute because any more than that and it shatters the chocolate shell.
I mean, it's a very delicate thing.
It's definitely like they take their time to really understand the mass manufacturing game.
Yeah.
And the big strides they make, or the ones that they're really proud of, are about their vans and about how many vans they've got on the road, about how many stockists they've got, all the countries that they're selling to. It's definitely also a very family business.
Yeah.
You know, the way that the family looks after each other, the way they're involved in the community, the way that all the family work for Tunnocks.
Yeah.
And you can only imagine that when someone like Archie, who seems to be someone that's filled with character, capital C character, that he had done this thing where his, like, for his 1 year, the Christmas, what you give employees?
Oh, your bonus.
Your bonus was... if you worked for the 2 weeks every day of Hogmanay, mm-hmm. then you got a bottle of whiskey.
Wow.
I had a decent bottle of whiskey as well. And if you didn't, then you got an alarm clock.
Oh, okay. That's
which
like
I'm sure would have also
early
have
stage
been,
capitalism.
I feel like the alarm clock would have also been a decent enough bonus.
It's a home furnishing.
Something. This is I work in the third sector. Like I don't know how common bonuses are.
I've never had a sniff of a bonus.
No. Like, academia. No.
Academia. What?
Really
bonus?
That research out the park. Well ahead of schedule.
You might get a permanent job.
Yeah, no, exactly. We're going to pay you this month. How about that? This brings us to Act 3, Boyd Tunnock. So Boyd obviously he's been brought up inside of the business.
Yeah, on every level.
And he served in the army, in the catering corps.
Right.
He joins as a baker's apprentice first in 1949, goes away and serves, come back, gets really involved in the business, puts together the tea cake and clearly has an understanding for both the confectionery game, the ruthlessness of business, the inventiveness of business, and the value which is in that Tunnock's name.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it wasn't maybe as fraught as his father taking over the business, because that was obviously steeped in trauma.
Yeah, and
post-war, coming home, your dad's died, you're in charge, fix it. But it still must have shook the business.
Yeah, massively. And it's... I feel like there must be so much pressure when you're inheriting something that successful.
Yeah.
And also, like, that successful that's gone through, at this point, two world wars and still survived. Like, if you become the Tunnock that takes the helm and ruins things, like, that's a big failure.
And actually, there's, you know, his dad and his granddad, because of the, like, the variety of their business, they could pull in extra catering, they could put extra into the bakery itself, you know. Tunnock's now, when Boyd takes it over, is a confectionery mass producer that's sending Tunnocks out to the world.
Yes.
And to keep people employed, people that have probably been working in your factory since the war, since before the war, and to keep the Tunnock's name at the top, I think he's handled it generally quite well.
Yeah.
I would have said.
The fact that he's still phoning people who inquire through the website. Like, that is keeping
these two twats, the mics, call themselves a food history podcast.
That is keeping a close handle on relations with the family. It's not like he's retired and has nothing to do with it.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you can Google it.
Mm-hmm.
Sir Boyd Tunnock is 92.
92.
And still very much involved in the business.
Wow. That's amazing.
As evidenced by...
It's phoning me. Love that.
But we're coming into the era of Boyd Tunnock is the era that I'm mostly familiar with, because it's the beginning of Tunnock being kind of cemented as an icon, as a brand. Tunnock's begins to advertise. It's more than just the vans now.
Yeah.
It's about carving out a space out within the confectionery sector to plant Tunnock's. It celebrated 100 years. In 1990, which was just one wee shy year before I was born. Thank you very much.
So yeah, this is Tunnock's in our lifetime.
Yeah.
That it is. I mean, it's crazy that by this point, I mean, because I think of the 19th century a lot, you're thinking, oh, it's, you know, late Victorian, but actually by this point, I feel like almost like that first half of the 20th century is probably far harder to sustain yourself in business. We have the rise of things like Cadbury's in the Victorian period. And by this point, Tunnock's is... like, I have such a Willy Wonka narrative in my head, right? Of, like, these vans going all around the west coast of Scotland and TV adverts by this point. They seem to have really... they came in at a point where advertising food was more than just like lists in a greengrocer. It was about images. It was about colours. It was about like consistency. And they nailed it.
After we had our very brief chat, there was a couple of questions I wanted to put to them. So I said, there's a running theme of community in how newspapers spoke both about your granddad and your father's business.
Mm-hmm.
Did they live by a mantra or a guiding principle? And he said, my grandfather and my father before me always lived by the mantra, always give quality.
Nice. Oh, that's good.
And I think also Boyd talked a lot about the fact that they were very clear in business that you have to make a product that people are willing to pay for.
Yes.
They were not perhaps going to try and forge out a path post-World War II in prepackaged salads in Scotland. They were giving high quality, high sugar confectionery.
Delicious, comforting, joyous cakes and yes. biscuits. And I think I love that about like the tea cake in particular is a tea cake is not a transportable thing. When you buy them, they're in these lovely like rigid boxes. You can see through the plastic window, you can see the foil, you can see the shininess. I've been at conferences or I've been like out with someone who's bought me a tea cake or something like that. A tea cake is not something you can put in your pocket or shove in your backpack and go at home.
No.
By the time you get it home, it's flattened and dismangled and there's nothing sadder.
No.
And I love the fact that this is, like, they've not gotten away from that. They're still selling this quite fragile but delicious thing. It's so dainty.
Yeah.
And you need to, like, take care of it. Like, that is, like, a marker of, like, the quality of it. They're not just,
They're not robust.
No, they're not robust. Quite
not at all. More the fool for the munchmallow.
with their rigid gelatin.
Marshmallows. I asked him, I was interested to know, was the Tunnock's Bakery, before they kind of really took into confectionery, did they have a speciality that was famous in the local community? And he said, Tunnock's was built up around quality and value for money, and the Scotch pies were one of their specialities.
Oh, I wish they still did savoury things.
I know. Well, I think there is a Tunnock's Bakery.
Yeah, that's true.
And we should go and check
it
out.
We should go and do a bakery.
Yeah. There's, so for those of you who don't know, a Scotch pie is a hot water crust pastry, which is filled with a kind of spiced and seasoned, what would have been mutton for most of Scottish history, more recently tends to mostly be beef.
Yeah.
And or a mix of
pork,
minces.
Probably, yeah.
It's a very savoury, quite small pie that you would either pour like gravy into. Some people I know will do beans. I think that's a very English thing.
Yeah, beans on a pie.
But it's like a classic for a football game.
Yes.
Or at your local butcher, every Scottish butcher will have a Scotch pie.
Unlike a tea cake, a Scotch pie is inherently durable.
Yes.
Like, you could put a Scotch pie in your
pocket. I just spat directly on them. Yeah, you could, at the end of time, there will be, share the crustaceans
and
Scotch pie.
I used to get them for lunch when I was in secondary school. Like, they used to, like, let us out the school. You could walk down into the village, and one of the few places that, like, let kids in and would sell them lunch was the butcher's, and you would go and you'd get this, like, Scotch pie in a paper bag.
Amazing.
So good.
I was always a Scotch pie over a sausage roll, personally.
Yeah.
That being said, it was never my favourite. I was more of a macaroni pie.
I think steak pie and macaroni pie are my two faves.
Yeah, or a steak, not actually a steak pie.
Yeah.
A Bell's steak
but
pie.
But similarly, you can have it in your hand.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
nothing is delicate about that cuisine.
No.
And yet I was interested in, because all of the family seemed to have had this real relationship with the army, both him and his dad obviously serving, and I wanted to know if that had kind of set them up for what seemed to be this mass catering they did.
Yeah.
And around their community. And he was just saying, no, like, his father's time in the army and his time in national service, it gave him a good grounding for business. And I think what he's talking about there is discipline.
Yeah, practicality, pragmatics, timelines.
Exactly.
Yeah, schedules.
Exactly.
I mean, it is, and I'm gonna talk about a Victorian cookbook author who we don't talk about because she's English and overrepresented, but I'm going to bring up Beaton. And her book of household management is like, the mistress of a house is like the commander of an army. And I feel like the master of a confectionery company must also be like the commander of an army.
I wonder what it was like to work in there.
I would love to think it was a nice place to work.
Yes. The interesting thing about the conversation around Tunnock's and Tunnock's in the culture, because we want to think that Tunnock's was a lovely place to work.
Yes.
Because it means so much to our Scottish identity.
Yeah.
And because we want the things that we celebrate and identify with to be good in the world.
Exactly.
And to meet with our ideas of
our
fairness and equality.
About ourselves. Exactly.
Exactly.
And this is a confectionery company, right?
Yeah.
So the very roots of sugar and chocolate and cocoa in Scotland are not built upon sugar and spice and everything nice. They're built upon slavery and the suffering of people. And there's a very unsavory history there that we're good at glossing over.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. There's something there about why Tunnocks matter so much to people. We do. I feel like we care about it as a brand. Like, as I was saying, you know, you get cushions shaped like tea cakes. There's like tea towels. You can. It's so recognizable that it's ascended the actual product itself.
And I think when I speak on this, I'm coming from the point of view of being a very poor boy in the 90s, growing up in the west of Scotland. There was very few things that you could point at that you could be proud of.
Well, it's the whole, like, it's the train spotting line, right? It's like, it's shite being Scottish. Like, we're a nation.
I don't subscribe to that.
No, me neither. I love being Scottish.
I think part of that is just, like, when you dive into the history, you gain a better perspective on the ingenious of Scottish people.
Oh, I mean, we invented or innovated or came up with so much stuff, right?
So much stuff.
Really good stuff.
Don't ask me to name any of it right now.
Yeah, real good stuff. Take it from a certified historian. We came up with some good stuff.
But I also think from, like, there's a lot that's been brought in with Tunnocks in the recent, the last 20 years around, is Tunnocks a British company or a Scottish company? We like to kind of plant on it through transference, our own ideals, and then their identity is batted around
like a bit of
a tennis match,
a political hotcake. One of the things that Tunnocks is good at is, like, they've identified this strong brand and it's proliferated, and I think people get so embroiled and upset in these debates because it has become something that's recognizable and comfortable and familiar and, as you say, can be celebrated. And that's not something that we want to let go of, and I don't think we need to. Like, it is something we're proud of as a nation, and that's because, I feel like that's probably because it's always been tied into these ideas of family, community. You know, it was very much a grassroots business that has just kind of grown, but in a way that seems really sustainable and still... You know, the bakery and everything's still based in Uddingston. It's quite amazing.
Well, I was very interested to find out from Mr. Boyd the answers to our 8 questions that we ask everyone.
Yes. Oh, excellent. Read them to me. So, what is his morning roll order?
He prefers a soda scone.
Oh.
With bacon.
Oh, wow.
Left field.
That is left field, that's for sure.
But he's an innovator.
Yeah.
So we'll give it to him.
We'll give it a try, and it's probably delicious.
How does he take... No, sorry. Bread, plain or pan?
I'm going to guess...
Go for it.
Plain.
He's a plain man?
Yes.
How does he take his porridge?
Surely it has to be sweet.
Just with milk.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. No tea cakes mushed into it.
The big question.
What's his favourite Tunnocks product?
What's his favourite Tunnocks product? A caramel wafer.
Ah, he's an old school boy.
He's an old school. Now, we asked him if he had a family recipe that he'd want to put into a cookery book.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's not sure.
I mean, I feel like Tunnocks is responsible for a lot of key Scottish recipes, so we can probably let him off with that one.
I do what we'll do, we'll add in the tea cake.
The tea cake, yeah.
His invention.
Imagine you'd be like, oh, I'll just put in the family tea cake. Like,
yeah, I'll just put in, you know, that little recipe I invented 40 years ago.
The tea cake.
What ingredient do you reach for most in the kitchen? He said butter.
Love it, man after my own heart.
Yes. What is your favourite Scottish word? He said bra.
Bra. We've not had bra yet. That's a good one.
And when his first job that he was given in the kitchen was washing the dishes.
Nice. Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Lindsay. And I want to say, I doubt he will listen to this, but someone in the Tunnocks team might, to give my absolute thanks and adoration to Sir Boyd Tunnock.
Best regards to Sir Boyd Tunnock.
The last question I did have for him was about what happened to the cosy with the two T's on it.
Yeah.
And he has an answer.
Well, they're these, the TTs, they're two brass Ts. They're in the factory down in one of the engineers, and they're still, my late brother Tom, he had them put in when the cement was soft.
Yeah.
And they're actually stuck in there. They're for keeps, you know. And it's always something to what you've done in the past, you know, and how you got on, you know.
So they're still in the factory today.
They're still in the factory today.
Yeah.
Until next time, Lindsay.
Until next time, Peter.
This episode of the Scottish Root History Podcast was hosted by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist. This episode was produced by Tenement Kitchen.